across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
On Nolan Today, we learn of now how people within NI Water are being balloted for strike actions. What type of winter of discontent? We were talking about health staff yesterday, possibly striking. Now, water staff being balloted for possible strike action. What's this place going to look like if these strikes go ahead? And how can we afford these public sector pay rises? Another question is, why shouldn't we afford to give people what they were promised or the cost of living increases? We're doing that this morning. This incredible story that was on Good Morning Ulster about someone with autism in a mental health hospital. And all of the experts think they should be released, but there's nowhere for them to go. How many other people is that happening to? What are we going to do about it? Those stories and more, the Cresswell murder and the lack of proper policing, police investigation, some questions are around that, learning for the police around that, all coming up on the Nolan Show this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Welcome along to the Nolan Show. Before we get into our top story this morning, I was driving down the road. That is such an important report on Good Morning Ulster today about Sebastian, who's 19. And the health service cannot find him a place so that he can leave a mental health hospital. The health service don't want to talk about him individually. Well, we will. And his mother will. And Good Morning Ulster will. His name is Sebastian. And the health service saying that while they cannot talk about individuals. Well, here's the point. How long are these people? Good Morning Ulster have established that up to 25 people in adult mental health hospitals can be discharged but have nowhere to go. To the health minister this morning, Mike Nesbitt, how on earth is this going to be acceptable for any length of time? How many people driving down into work this morning are shocked that we've got people who should be out in the secure facility, secure for them, as in suitable support for them in our community? And the Southern Trust, we remain committed to working with other partner agencies to fight the most suitable supports. While we do not comment on individual circumstances of any service user, well, isn't that convenient? You do not comment about individuals. What type of health service is this that doesn't comment about individuals when the mother is commenting about her own son? Like, what is going on? And you listen to that report. Go back on BBC Sounds and listen to that report this morning. Now, Nesbitt, the health minister, he's fighting for more money. So we need to look at this and we need to look at what's going on. And look, if you're among that category and you want to contact me, nolan@bbc.co.uk, we know now that, 25 people, this is what Kabir are telling us this morning, 25 people in mental health hospitals who can be discharged, but we can't find them anywhere to go. What is going on? And then I nearly crashed the car this morning when the head of Autism NI was saying that they looked at the UK and there was someone held in one of these places for 30 years. I couldn't believe it. And that wasn't Northern Ireland. But what's it to stop happening here in Northern Ireland? And to the Southern Health and Social Care Trust, I would just ask this question of you. While we do not comment on individual circumstances of any service user, why? Who's developed that policy? They then also tell Good Morning Ulster this morning the Southern Trust cannot comment on the waiting list policy for admission to each independent sector care home. So what are we all to do? Sit back and just, I don't know, leave these people there for 2 years, 3 years? How much is too much? and that mother fighting for her son. Nolan at bbc.co.uk is the email address, 0330 80 55 55. Such important journalism this morning. I want to go back to Gordon Ulstert sitting there on BBC Sounds. Right, our top story this morning. We can reveal the Chief Constable John Boucher has met Northern Ireland's top judge, Dame Siobhan Keegan, about close protection. This is after Boucher is essentially saying all of these judges in Northern Ireland, he can't afford to protect them anymore, and some of them are going to lose their close protection officers. A third of the entire PSNI, a third, we'll get into the third figure in just a second when I stack up exactly how much it is. But the PSNI in Northern Ireland, here's the figure we do know. It provides bodyguards to 98 individuals. And Boucher's saying, hold on a second here, that's more than double the amount of people protected by the Met in London, which is the UK's largest police force. Members of the judiciary, they make up more than half of the people the PSNI are protecting. You look at the dissident threat here. So this is why this is an interesting story. What will happen to these judges? They lose their bodyguards. Some of them lose their bodyguards at various times. How will we ensure they are safe? It's not just the judiciary that get bodyguards, it's politicians and other senior police officers. John Boucher had this to say about the demands on his officers.
The close protection issue, I've met the Lady Chief Justice on that issue. I've asked to meet the judges. A date has now been set for me to meet the judges. We've shared a policy that's been crafted very well by Mel Jones around how we intend to deal with protection issues. We've had discussions about this around the proportionality of the protection levels that we're currently providing here. I think we've got, the number changes very slightly, but I think it's maybe 98 protected persons currently. That's unsustainable. I think the Met have below 40, if you look at the sizes of the organisations. So I am due to meet the judge, and there is a date before, I'm pretty sure it's before Christmas. So it's going to be an interesting conversation.
And just listen to how John Boucher responded when he was asked this question by the DUP's Trevor Clark.
Will you take the fear of a judicial decision by some individuals? Will you take the fear of that from you making a decision to do the right thing in terms of the organisation? Or will you live under the fear of the judiciary taking a judicial review?
Well, that's a very easy question for me, Trevor. I was in the courts this week. I will deal with things as I think they need to be dealt with. I won't be influenced by anything other than the information, the threat. We'll do a proper process that's transparent. There'll be an appeals process to that. And I think everybody in this room knows that this is a particularly litigious place and judicial reviews are like confetti. But we've got to do something about the numbers of people that we cover through close protection. But we've got to make sure we go through a proper process.
Well, let's speak to John Burrows, who's a former senior police officer. Morning to you, John.
Morning, Stephen.
So how do we weigh this up in Northern Ireland in terms of, look, Boucher's essentially saying all of these judges can't continue to be protected with the amount of money he has with these personal protection officers, these bodyguards. How does that weigh up when there's still an active, real dissident threat?
It's tricky. I mean, look, the first thing I would say is that this will be very controversial. We'll go down it with like a lead balloon with the judiciary, which is why previous chief constables, you know, sometimes haven't touched it with a barge pole. Of those 98 people who received protection in Northern Ireland, I would give you probably a ballpark figure, but 80% of them are judges. Okay, so the judges are a huge volume of those people who get protected. It's hugely costly. Every car costs about £100,000, each one of those armoured cars. There's millions of pounds it costs to deliver that. And you're probably in a situation in Northern Ireland where the level of protection afforded to the judges is based on the threat that used to exist as opposed to currently exists. Now, threat is very difficult to assess because there's a lot of known unknowns. You know, dissidents have never ruled out attacking judges, but actually judges have not been in their sights in the last number of years. I mean, I can't remember the last time a judge was attacked. That doesn't mean we get complacent, but it does mean that John Boucher, who's faced with trying to deliver policing with a reduced budget, has to make cuts somewhere. And, you know, the cuts that have been posed in his budget have consequences. So he's going to look at this piece. He's going to have to look at, is there other countermeasures that can be brought in that are cheaper, and start to individually assess the risk to judges, as opposed to giving the option of everyone getting covered.
I'm remembering last year, wasn't there graffiti put in a wall in Newton Ards about a judge and on a courthouse in Newton Ards last year about a judge?
Yes, there was. And look, judges are always going to, they're part of the justice system, and very clearly it's important that our judges feel safe coming in back and forth to work, that they feel safe during their job. I mean, all around the world, you might get graffiti, as we do it here in Northern Ireland. There's a difference between that and real credible threats. But what each case is now going to have to be assessed on its merits. And if you did an individual threat assessment on each judge, it may well be that a lot of those judges wouldn't meet the criteria. Now, I think there's two issues coming out of this, Stephen. The first is, how do we manage the judiciary through this? Because it's a bit like police officers. At times I've had to say to officers, we're going to move from one style of policing to the other. We're going to move out of the armoured cars and we're going into soft-skinned cars. And that creates a real fear. You'll have judges who have no experience of getting in their own car and driving to court and back. And this will be very, very worrying for them. The second thing we need to always bear in mind is there's always intelligence gaps, right? So you can never rule out the fact that dissidents might react to this news and say, well, look, we haven't really taken on judges for a while because, well, they're protected and there's easier targets. But perhaps now a judge would be seen as a softer target. The countermeasure to that is, look, when you've got less resources, you've got to allocate your resources according to threat and risk. And John Boucher clearly feels that too much resources allocated to protecting scores of judges when the threat against them is relatively low. I will say just one caveat is, of course, each case can be assessed on its merits, and there will still be protection given to judges at different times if there's a high threat come in or they were dealing with a high profile trial. But I think the blanket approach to saying the 80 or 90 judges, you can get driven to work in an armoured car with two people at a cost of millions, is coming to an end.
So we know that of the protection officers that are on the ground in Northern Ireland, 122 officers are assigned to the close protection unit, 22 posts are vacant. They're having to draw in other resources. It's about 60% of those officers are for the judiciary. And we also know, I was saying earlier about that third figure, a third of the PSNI's entire overtime bill goes on these bodyguards. So you think of the overtime bill for the entire police force in Northern Ireland, a third of that overtime is for close protection. So it's an interesting story in its own right. And that threat level that there is in Northern Ireland from the dissidents, obviously the Chief Constable wouldn't be weighing this up, John Boucher, if he thought he couldn't protect the judiciary and others properly. So he doesn't think they need close protection officers all of the time, in other words, right?
Yeah, that's what he's saying. And each case would have to be then assessed on its merits, whether you get full CPU protection, close protection, you get picked up in an armoured car, driven to work, watched while you're at work, driven back home, whether other countermeasures can be put around courthouses, around judges' houses. There's new technology, there's all kinds of security packages, and whether each case will be threat assessed on its each individual basis. What I will say to you, Stephen, is this: two things. One, I think a judicial review is, you know, quite likely. But the second thing is, you mentioned the overtime cost. I'm aware of officers who are removed from frontline duties across Northern Ireland to backfill for the close protection unit. So you'll actually have officers taken out of neighbourhoods across Northern Ireland. Mostly they're TSG officers, public order officers, but your officers who are removed from other duties in Northern Ireland to backfill the fact that we don't have enough close protection officers. So it does have a massive drain on the PSNI's resource, and it's something that needs looked at. And look, the Chief Constable has said policing is going to be unrecognisable. If the politicians keep whittling away at the policing budget, the ability for the police to give her a Rolls-Royce service is gone. You know, those days are gone, and this is going to be one of the most high-profile, maybe controversial changes, but more changes are coming up the line, because policing is going to be unrecognisable when there's not enough money and not enough people.
I wonder how judges, obviously they must be they must be tough characters in their own right. I wonder how they're going to react to this.
Look, I've had a little bit of interaction on these issues before, just in districts when you've engaged with judges about their security. This will be a massive culture shock. You know, some judges know no different than getting picked up, and it's going to be something for them to really have to be supported through, to be given security advice, to be given other reassurance. So I do think we have to manage the concerns of the judiciary, because they're absolutely vital part of a democratic process, that we have a free and independent judiciary who feel comfortable to go in and out and do their job. And that is going to need to be managed very carefully, and that's going to need a lot of communication, a lot of support. Okay. Sometime.
John, we'll come back to this story, and we'll come back to other stories as well with you in a few minutes' time. 030 30 80 55 55, if you want to pick up the phone to us this morning. The Lady Chief Justice Office has confirmed that the Chief Constable has met with her. The Chief Constable appraising her of how he is looking now at close protection services in Northern Ireland. Next, the GMP and Unite unions have told the Nolan Show they're in the process of balloting their members in Northern Ireland Water for industrial action. Now, both ballots close in the first week of December. We were talking yesterday, about health workers potentially striking in Northern Ireland. Language was being used of about the winter of discontent. And now, on top of the health workers potentially striking in January and February of next year, here we are learning this morning that Northern Ireland water staff are being balloted, those ballots closing in just a couple of weeks' time. This is about pay. This is about a dispute over the failure to address the 2023-2024 pay award in line with other public sector employees. Could this result in a disruption to water supplies like it did in 2015? The financial journalist Paul Gosling with us today. Morning to you, Paul.
Morning, Stephen.
This winter of discontent, this seems to be, there's never a day goes by now where we're not hearing about different threats of strike action. What's going on, Paul?
Well, this is a complete mess, isn't it? And the responsibility essentially lies with ministers for not taking tough decisions over a number of years. Keith Archibald this week, in the announcements related to the monitoring round, said that it's time for public sector transformation. Look, I've been living here for nearly a quarter of a century, and for a quarter of a century, people have been talking about the need for public sector transformation. And really, we have to have ministers getting on with the job. Now, there is a model that works much better in terms of Northern Ireland Water, because clearly it is having struggling difficulties within the public sector, and it can be operating as a halfway house, what's called mutualisation. That's the model that's used in Wales with Glas Cymru, but it's also used in terms of the electricity interconnector between Scotland and Northern Ireland, and it's also used for much of the electricity networks in the United States. So we need to be much more innovative about actually how we get these services running in ways that give them more flexibility to operate.
But if we've got so many across so many different areas of public service in Northern Ireland, workers and unions contemplating strike action, what could this country look like next year in terms of the daily functioning of it?
Well, hopefully things will actually get sorted out. But the problem is that we have to have strikes before ministers take tough decisions. I mean, if you're going to have a workforce going on strike, there will be a solution somewhere along the line. I mean, it's about people negotiating in a tough way, because ministers aren't in a position to accede initially. I mean, we've already got health sector economists who are saying, well, Mike Nesmith might say that he can't meet the public sector workers, the health service workers' demands, but actually, ultimately, he will have to find the money. And, you know, if you've got large budgets, then you are going to have some flexibility. But what we've got, which is the biggest problem in terms of Northern Ireland Water, is the capital spend. I mean, we've got building projects that can't go ahead. We've got building projects that have being put on hold halfway through, because we need to be spending around $500 million to $600 million a year on improving the infrastructure for wastewater and for water supply, and we're only spending around half of that. And so you've got to make big decisions, and the problem we've got is that ministers are reluctant to take unpopular decisions, difficult decisions, but also because of the structure of the executive, it's very difficult to get any decision across the line between ministers.
The last time there was a strike, 2015, 9,000 households in Northern Ireland were left without water. Could we be facing something like that again?
Well, obviously, if we get to the point where the strike action, then yeah, we can. I mean, that's quite obvious. The difficulty is that we have to have big picture solutions. We can't just simply muddle through in the way we do at the moment. I mean, ultimately, if workers go on strike, there's going to have to be a settlement, and that settlement's going to cost money. So you might as well recognise the realities and get on and sort things out now.
So how do they sort it out, Paul, finally, if they don't have enough money? If they don't have enough money in the executive, here we are back to this, how do you square a circle? The executive have ruled out water charges, so they've ruled out that, well, certainly some in the executive have ruled them out.
Yes.
So if they've ruled out that extra revenue mechanism, they've ruled out other revenue raising mechanisms, they don't have enough money, how are they going to meet these pay demands across the public sector?
Well, ministers are going to have to be flexible. I mean, mutualisation is not an immediate solution. And actually, I think it's only two parties that ruled it out, which is Sinn Féin and the DUP. The other parties, I think, are open to a more flexible approach. But ultimately, ministers are going to have to find the money from elsewhere. I mean, because you've got £18 billion in total spending in Northern Ireland from the public sector. So there will be opportunities to find money from elsewhere. So they're going to have to actually look at their budgets and decide what actually perhaps they could save on or actually delay spending on.
Well, that would require tough decisions.
Yes, absolutely. And you need ministers to get on with it. I mean, I'm fed up. I'm sure most listeners are fed up with the fact that we've got ministers that aren't willing to take tough decisions. They have to get on with it. That's what their job is.
Paul Gosling, thank you. Let's come back to our top story this morning. John Boucher, the Chief Constable, saying that he thinks that the number of bodyguards assigned to judges in Northern Ireland will have to reduce. The Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent, Alison Morris, with us today. Good morning to you, Alison.
Good morning.
And Boucher making the point beyond the judges. He's looking at the Met, the UK's biggest police force, and he's saying there are 90 odd people being protected here in Northern Ireland and only 40 odd in London. And he's saying, what's going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, we know what's going on. This is basically a hangover from our past and at a time when, and we know that judges here were under serious threat, as were some senior politicians, and therefore this type of protection would have been warranted at one time. I don't think it is now. You know, we do live in relative peace. I'm not saying there isn't a threat that still exists, but that threat has been so reduced that it would be much easier managed, and easier managed in a way that wouldn't actually require over 90 people to have personal protection. A lot of those people do require 24-hour personal protection for very obvious reasons, but certainly not up until 90. You know, there has just been a routine here where, especially when it comes to judges, that they're given this type of personal protection when many of them don't need it. Usually it would be, if you're talking about somewhere like London, if you had a judge who was sitting in a big high-profile terror trial, maybe like an Islamic terror trial, well, then they would have the personal protection. But it would usually only last for the length of that trial. It wouldn't be for life, if you know what I mean. It would only be for the length of time that the threat existed.
And yet, Alison, obviously John Caldwell from the PSNI, his name will be in our minds. He was attacked. John was shot. Thank goodness he's still alive, shot in front of his son. If we're relying on intelligence, there are intelligence gaps, Alison.
There'll always be intelligence gaps. And the point is, I mean, you have to have your intelligence as up to date as possible, but it doesn't mean that instead of having your intelligence at the level that it should be, that you just randomly send, you know, two police officers on a constant shift to do armed protection for people. I think that is probably, when it comes to a police force that's under serious financial pressure, is not the way to handle any potential threat. There was a serious intelligence gap when it came to John Caldwell. We know why that happened. I mean, not to go into off on a tangent, but after Operation Arbacia, there was a feeling, I suppose, that the new IRA were somehow neutered and they were no longer a threat, and therefore the foot was taken off the pedal as such when it came to intelligence. And I'm assuming that isn't the case now as I'm sitting here speaking to you.
Do you think judges will accept this? I wonder, will they take this land down? Will they fight back? Maybe they agree.
Some judges do require it, and the fact is you can't take it off all judges, because some judges do require it. So say if you're a judge and you're sitting through one of those big terror trials, and then bear in mind the length of time that those trials take in Northern Ireland is, you know, when you look at compared to London, they can take years here. I mean, for example, if you take the trial of Colin Duffy and Alec McCrory and Harry Fitzsimmons, which ended with no one got found guilty, by the way, by the end of it. It took over 10 years. And, you know, judges would have been sitting through that, listening to disclosure and really sensitive information, and would therefore part protection throughout that. But you could argue, yes, that they do. And I was on Speaking to You one morning when Mark Hamill, the judge in Newton Ards, arrived to work to have his name painted on the wall.
That's
with
right.
A target beside it.
Yeah.
He has now, you know, a protection officer who actually sits in the court beside him, because the threat level to him was so high. So we know, but that should be based on a case-by-case basis rather than just giving judges blanket protection. There should be a threat, an assessment threat level carried out for each and every one of them to determine whether they require that kind of protection.
If that assessment is being applied to judges who, look, by the very nature of what they do, they're going to infuriate people and they're going to infuriate criminals. If that contemporary ongoing assessment is the way forward, should that be applied to politicians as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have the like of John Caldwell. He does have 24-hour protection, and there's a reason for that. He continues to get threats on a regular basis. Our politicians here also have protection. That is usually just reserved to the First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, and the Justice Minister. But after you leave that job, you continue to have that protection. So Arning Foster would still have police protection. Peter Robinson had his police protection up until about a year ago. He was still, albeit I don't think he used it that often. But yeah, I mean, they hold on to that protection long after, I think, that they would require it, and there should maybe be a relook at that. But you can understand why they're serving politicians in those high-profile roles. There's an argument. But I mean, that would only be three people. That would, you know, wouldn't be the burden that the Chief Constable is speaking about. That's more the number, I think, of people in the legal profession that they're having to protect day and daily, even though they have had no identifiable threat issued against them.
Okay, we're going to talk about Cresswell next. Stay there, Alison. I know that John Burrows is with us. First, let's get the news from the BBC. The Stephen Nolan Show. Thanks for being with me this Wednesday morning, 030-30-80-55-55. The Cresswell case, an incredible case. The PSNI and I said it wasn't rigorous enough when investigating the death of show jumper Katie Simpson. This comes after an ombudsman report found the police investigation flawed and that it failed her family. It identified multiple failures, including a willingness to believe the account of Jonathan Cresswell, the man who was later charged with her murder. PSNI Assistant Chief Constable Davy Beck admitted officers did not act quickly enough in responding to concerns that were raised around Katie's death.
It is clear that we were not rigorous enough in our pursuit of all potential lines of inquiry, and we did not act quickly enough in responding to some of the concerns that were raised around Katie's death. We relied too much on the lack of any presenting medical evidence around what had happened to Katie when she was first admitted to hospital, and indeed on the forensic post-mortem that was conducted on the 11th of August 2020. Our systems failed to properly identify Creswell's related and serious offending. We acknowledge this and we reaffirm our position that we must and we will do better moving forward.
Katie's mother, Nolene Mullen, gave this reaction.
I just don't think the people who are responsible for what's happened here from the start are nowhere to be seen. And it leaves you feeling empty, like you've really, there's been no achievement made for me. And I wanted them to be made accountable, but I don't think they ever will be.
Nolene Mullen also said if it weren't for others, Cresswell would still be a threat to other women.
Like he would be out there today controlling girls, raping girls, and murdering girls. There's no question about it.
Well, Alison Morris, as I was saying earlier, Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent, still with us. Former senior police officer John Burrows back with us this morning as well. Alison, what went on here? How were there so many failures in investigating this? It's an incredible story.
It's shocking. And I mean, we've known that there was so many failings in Katie Simpson's case. And, you know, myself and colleagues of your own in the BBC have looked at this case and tried to get to the bottom of exactly what went wrong and why this man was, you know, allowed to do what he did and was treated in many ways almost like a grieving victim rather than, you know, the killer of this young woman. And the Ombudsman, you know, goes some way to explain the procedures that went wrong along the way, but not the why. Not why. I mean, it's just feeling after feeling after feeling.
So spell those out to us, Alison. What were the feelings? Spell out what happened that's unbelievable.
So Katie was a show jumper. She was 21 years of age. She had been living with her sister in Cresswell, I think, since she was about 11 years of age. And since that time, you'd been abusing and coercively controlling her. But this man is someone with a documented history of violence against women. His former partner, Abby Lyle, he was convicted and imprisoned for really serious domestic abuse of her. And she bravely came out and spoke publicly about that. The day that Katie died, he claimed he had found her trying to take her own life, and instead of phoning an ambulance, he put her in a car and started driving in the direction of Alton McElvin and Katie's car. He phoned on the way there, and he was told to pull over to the side of the road and the ambulance would meet him and to start giving her CPR. He actually made all the sort of noises as if he was doing this, but he wasn't at all. When the ambulance arrived, Katie was still sitting upright in the front seat of the car, and she was partially clothed and unresponsive. They put her in the ambulance and told him to follow behind it. He didn't. He went and changed cars and changed clothes. He had a number of women who were helping him in this, who helped give him an alibi, and two, he took his clothes away and washed them. He arrived at the hospital in completely different clothes, and he told them because Katie was black and blue, she had been beaten really badly and sexually assaulted. He told them she'd fallen from a horse the day before. At no point did anyone go and try and seek independent verification of this and find that anyone seen Katie fallen from the horse and what had exactly happened the day before.
They didn't check.
No, they didn't check. And there was, you know, people at the hospital had expressed concerns that her injuries were not consistent with what he claimed. He claimed he had found her hanging. The injuries on her neck were not consistent with that. They were ignored. That there was a nurse who had actually said this young woman's black and blue down below and something needs to be done, and she was ignored. There were friends of Katie's who tried to raise the alarm as well. They didn't forensically examine the house where she was found to see if it was a crime scene. They didn't forensically examine her car.
They examine the house?
No, they didn't. They didn't. And I know that there was things that were cleaned up from that house before that family moved out of that house not long after that. But no, it was never forensically examined. Her phone was missing and there was no attempt to try and find her phone. Cresswell had actually thrown it in the field because he had been threatening her, because Katie, who he controlled in every aspect of her life, had met a lovely young man who had actually showed an interest in her and who she had told she was absolutely terrified of Cresswell. He found out she'd been with him the night before, and that was what sparked the initial jealous rage. But Katie had been subjected to abuse for years at Cresswell's hands. None of this was checked. And in fact, the CSNI chief constable himself told the policing board, and I was sitting there when he said it, that when police arrived at the hospital, the only person they spoke to was Cresswell, our killer. He was the person who they spoke to. They didn't make any attempt to speak to anyone else from her family to see if any of them had any concerns. He controlled the entire thing. He stayed at the hospital throughout to make sure that Katie was never alone in case she did come out, although they had known. And also, there was no pictures taken of her injuries. There was no forensic swabs. There was no, what you would do is usually if someone had been a victim, even a suspected victim of a sexual assault, there would be, as you can imagine, numerous tests that would be carried out. None of that happened, and therefore a lot of opportunities were missed in terms of the early police investigation.
John Burrows, failure after failure after failure, to the point where people listening to this will think, what is going on? How can we have confidence if that is what happens in a murder investigation or an investigation where someone has died?
Yeah, look, very difficult reading, and even more difficult, of course, for the family of Katie Simpson. So my heart really goes out to them. Stephen, look, the police got this wrong. They've apologised. They've said they've embraced learning. There's been some accountability for some, as I understand, junior officers. But clearly this went wrong at the very start. One of the recommendations is that, you know, a sergeant should have attended the initial scene. And this has been an issue in policing for many, many decades nationally, that when you have sudden deaths, a sergeant goes. We don't leave it to the, you know, the most junior officer, constable. So you have initial quality assurance of what's here. Is this a sudden death that's non-suspicious? Is it suspicious? Is it unexplained? Is it potentially homicide? Because if you get it wrong at the start, you can go down a path, and what's happened in this case, they've been down a path that this is suicide, and therefore all of the investigative steps that Alison has outlined that weren't taken because they were saying, well, this is a suicide. And that mistake was made at the beginning, and then it was compounded when people weren't listening and being open-minded, when red flags were raised. And, you know, there are a number of issues. One of the biggest concerns for me is that when the police checked Cresswell on the police database, his very serious conviction for domestic violence against Abigail Lyle did not come up in the system. There was a woman he beat black and blue. And that didn't come up in the system.
Why not?
I still haven't got an explanation for that. The chief constable, I haven't heard from that. But, you know, there's a series of failings here. And it really is very disappointing.
Yeah, I'm just reading some BBC copy here, Alison, where the Ombudsman said police were aware from an early stage of the investigation that Cresswell had been convicted in 2010 for assaulting another woman.
They did say initially that when they checked the database that it didn't come up and that there's now been steps to rectify this so that it couldn't happen again. But they were aware because that they were informed by other people. So the court reporter and journalist Tanya Fowles contacted police because she had actually reported on Cresswell's previous conviction, and she had seen what had happened to Katie and said, by the way, I know this man, I've reported on his activities in the past, you're aware that he's, you know, a previous for violence. So it was red flagged. I don't know who else might have red flagged it, but I do know for a fact, because I've spoken to Tanya, that she definitely red flagged it with police. So whether that's how they were made aware of it or not, I don't know. But it would be shameful if that's how they were, how it did come to their attention. Look, listen, we know that this is a sad old problem. This is massive police failure. There was also women who were hanging around Cresswell, who protected him and who helped find an alibi too, who took his clothes away and washed them, all of that. So we know that there was, you know, failing after failing in terms of Cresswell's management. How people enabled him throughout his life to abuse these young women who were in his care because he was a trainer in that show jumping world, and he had the protection of them. But the police should have been able to look behind that. I really thought we were beyond the days of people who were treated like some sort of pillars of the community, who therefore were exempt from proper investigation when something like this happened. You know, this man was controlling these women, and he appeared to then control the police investigation, at least in those very early days. No one thought to dig a bit deeper. Well, in fact, someone did. We know that there was one police officer who continually tried to raise the alarm and was completely ignored in relation to that. We know that there was a nurse as well who raised concerns and who was ignored. We know that there was friends. There was a male friend of Katie's who attempted to make two police ombudsman complaints and was turned away because he wasn't a relative, and then eventually made a police ombudsman complaint about the fact that police hadn't retained notes of a complaint that he had made to them to try and get around that. And he ended up taking his own life as well. So he's another victim of this shambolic police investigation because of the weight of the fact that to his friend he knew she'd been murdered, and he just felt, I don't know what else was going on in his life, but I do know that his family felt very strongly that he had being the unspoken victim of this entire shambolic operation because he just wasn't being listened to.
Dino, one point, if you don't mind. My point around the fact that a previous conviction for domestic violence wasn't on the system, the police did find out about that previous conviction. One of the officers actually resorted to Google to find it out. My point is, it's actually a really serious problem if police officers check and a conviction for domestic violence isn't on the police system. That can cause problems going forward in other cases. So there's a range of things need identified in this case. This, you know, Katie was let down by a lot of people, and her family were let down by the police. And I'll make a final point as well in terms of, you know, we need to reflect as a society. I still find it inexplicable that despite being charged with murder and rape and actually trying to conceal this crime, that Cresswell was out on bail at the time of the trial and killed himself at the end of the trial. So, you know, I've raised that issue before. I just don't see why he was out on bail.
How was Cresswell able to manipulate so much, Alison? And how in a situation like this is the person closest to the deceased not an immediate suspect, even if the police are not saying so out loud?
Well, the fact that he claimed to have found her in those circumstances, the fact that he did something which none of us could conceive to, and if you find someone in an unresponsive state, would you lift them and put them in a car and start driving them to the hospital instead of phoning an ambulance and then trying to give them CPR? All of that should have raised red flags. He would have been the first person you would have looked at. But I do think that there's a real lesson here, and police should know this, and they do know this, and we do know that they get training from Women's Aid and all of that. But abusers, the worst kind of abusers, often present in public as the most charming people you could meet. They're charming and they're manipulative, and the reason they're like that is how else would they get people to fall to, how else would they then recruit new victims if they weren't, you know, if they looked like monsters, we would all be, they would be easily identified and we would stay away from them, but they don't. A lot of these people, like Cresswell, present themselves as successful in their line of work as being incredibly charming. Did that mean that the police should have been charmed by him when they arrived at the scene and he's crying and going, oh my goodness, it's terrible, poor Katie? No, they shouldn't have. They should have went, hold on, let's go right back to the beginning and look and see exactly what went on here and who this person is. But he controlled that entire narrative in that hospital. He controlled everything that was happening, and he was the only person who spoke to the police at the hospital. We know this because the chief constable himself said that. And that, to me, I will never understand with Katie's case is the why. Just why? If someone could explain why the suicide narrative was accepted, and then almost like they doubled down, almost like no matter who came forward and said, but this has happened, there has been a lack of, I think the ombudsman called it, you know, that there was a lack of investigative curiosity, something along those lines. There was just a complete lack of curiosity in terms of people saying, no, let's just spend time and see what happens here. And had it been, because we do have suicides and sudden deaths that might on the face of it look like an unexplained death, and they're investigated, and they could turn out to be the fact that, you know, that they are not crimes. You know, for instance, you know, we've had times as a journalist where we have been outside scenes where a house has been closed off and there's been police forensic officers, but it turns out someone fell down the stairs, there's been a lot of blood, and it turns out it's been a totally accidental death, or it has been in many cases a suicide. But surely it would be better to put the resources into it in those early few days to say, okay, that was a suicide, rather than they have to come back the following January and remember she was murdered in August and say, right, maybe we've got this wrong, and trying to start investigating something in reverse. And, you know, John would know better than me, but those initial days, the fact that there was no pictures taken of her injuries, that there was no sexual assault kit carried out in the hospital, all of that, you can't go back and get that evidence again, that's gone. You know, you can't go back in reverse and try and do that again. So that's why it's so important that these things are carried out at the start. And had it been a suicide, well then, what harm would have been done just by putting those police resources in for a few days to investigate that? But that's not what happened. He just said, I've found her trying to take her own life. Oh, it's a terrible, fake crocodile tears. And he was believed.
I guess that one of the fundamental questions here, have lessons been learned, John?
Well, look, I hope so. And, you know, look, there's a policy recommendation that a sergeant should attend the scene of every sudden death and every incident where there's a life-threatening injury. So that's a policy recommendation that's been made, has been accepted. I think the PS9 need to really, and it's going to be a difficult one, to really understand the mindset that is crept into policing, that you believe what you hear, that you don't be curious, that you're not open-minded to suspicions.
Well, that's
and
unfair,
red flags.
Isn't it? Because every police officer will be curious and open-minded. Surely,
well,
that's a basic.
Yes, I get that, Stephen. But in this, was it like a year before a murder inquiry was opened? You know, for a long time there were people turning up at the police station saying, "I think this is a murder." So, you know, there needs to be a deep dive into what went wrong here, and really culturally, systemically, policy, training, because we know we've got a femicide problem. We know that when women are murdered, it's normally by someone they know. And we know that those who control women are very coercive. This was a very clever, scheming individual. In the BBC Spotlight programme, when he actually had a shower after he murdered Katie Simpson, he had a cool shower, so he didn't create steam in the house, so those who tended the house didn't think, oh, someone just had a shower here. This is how manipulative and scheming this individual was. But still, the police should have picked it up. They should have been treating him with suspicion and with an open mind. And whenever you meet someone like that at hospital, actually the officer should really turn the body-worn video on. You start getting the initial statements made by people who were at the scene, so you can start capturing them evidentially. And, you know, the police need to look at the whole training around this, because this can never happen again. And it's terrible for the family.
And finally, Alison, will there be any more of a deep dive into this?
Yeah, there's two further police ombudsman complaints that have been lodged recently, and the police ombudsman said they're going to put the resources into making sure that they're carried out quite quickly. So one, we're told, informs an allegation against a police officer of something that could be allegedly criminal, and that will be carried out quite quickly. And then there's also an investigation. I mentioned those women who helped her as well. There's an investigation into how that was carried out. We know that there was four initially who were investigated, and three who were charged. They got suspended sentences after Cresswell died following the first day of his trial. We can argue all day long about our sentences and whether those, you know, they should have got suspended sentences or be sent to prison. But that aspect of the case is also being looked at in deeper detail by the police ombudsman. And then also remember, there's an inquest that will have to take place in the Kerry where all these details will come out again. So this is far from over. You know, the PSNI apologised yesterday, and you have to accept there's nothing else they could do but apologise in the circumstances. But, you know, there's still more that will come out. The inquest will almost be like the trial we didn't have.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Join us for another big night of BBC Children in Need.
Have we got a show for you?
With a Doctor Who exclusive.
We are going to rock through time.
Gladiator stars like you've never seen them before.
Gladiators, ready!
A BAFTA award winning global superstar taken to the stage for Strictly. Children going head to head with celebs on Graham Norton's Red Chair.
It's a bit of an ego crusher.
And so much more. Children in Need. Friday night at 7 on BBC iPlayer.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
It certainly is with the selection boxes. I've bought a couple.
Take a look at the 5 and 10. It's glistening once again. With candy canes and silver lanes that glow.
It's just 6 weeks until Christmas Day. How about taking the stress out of Christmas Day by going out for dinner? How about paying £345 per head? The Belfast Telegraph have been comparing some of the prices in Northern Ireland's top hotels. Their night editor, John Laverty's with me this morning. Morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Chef Danny Miller, owner of Stock Kitchen and Bar at St George's Market. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Well, John Laverty, this is some of your paper's journalism. Dinner at the Merchant, £345 per adult, £200 per child under 12.
Yeah, Stephen, I'll tell you this. This may shock a few people, the price of this, but you try getting a table at the Merchant this Christmas. I mean, one of the reasons that it costs £345 per adult head is because people want it. People want this sort of service. And also, another thing is that you have to bring in a lot of staff at Christmas, on Christmas Day, a lot of staff, and you have to pay them a lot, and that adds to the actual price. I mean, I have eaten in hotels on Christmas Day myself, and I actually really enjoyed it. You don't have to prepare everything, you don't have to clean up after you, and it's quite a pleasant experience. Personally, I would not pay £345.
I was trying to find somewhere open, funnily enough, just about a couple of weeks ago on Christmas Day, and I couldn't find anywhere open. There's a whole list here from your newspaper. Hastings Grand Central Hotel, 6-course fine dining menu, £210 per adult, £130 per child. The Fitzwilliam Hotel, £200 per adult, £95 per child. The Cloth Ear, £155 per adult. Birch Jazz Bar, Christmas lunch, £240 per adult. Danny Miller, those prices, people clearly are prepared to pay them. I'd wet myself, £345. I don't know when the last time is I've spent that. Danny, can these prices be justified?
Well, I think you've got to take into consideration that it's to get your staff in to work that day, you're probably going to pay them three, sometimes four times what they're normally paid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we close because I couldn't afford it. And not even that, Dara, I think Christmas, I think you need a break at some stage. And you work hard enough in December, so we close for 4 days over Christmas. And it's just, it is, things look, the cost of running the business is hard enough in this current climate with cost of energy, the cost of food.
Come close to the phone. I know you're on your way to yoga or something. But come close to the phone so that I can hear you.
So the cost, sorry, as I was saying, the cost of food, the cost of energy, the cost of running the business is just so expensive nowadays. And the profit margins aren't as big as people think they are.
But if you're going out, look, these businesses, I hear you both loud and clear. If you're asking staff to come in on Christmas Day, there's going to be a premium. And there has to be a premium to their work for doing that. But you take mum and dad and maybe two kids going out for Christmas Day. That's the guts of £1,000 for turkey and ham. £1,000.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, but the demand is clearly there because as our last caller says, you'll find that you'll hard to struggle to get a reservation. So it's supply and demand, Stephen, as well, and there's clearly a market for it. I do think it's more out of my price range, but clearly there's people that are going to afford it.
Stephen, it's a once in a year experience, and as there is a huge demand for it. I mean, if you want something for Christmas Day, you need to have booked it by now. That's what, even at that prices. And there are a couple of places that haven't actually mentioned what their prices are, and I suspect one of them, I'm not mentioning the name, I suspect one of them is even bigger than £345 per head.
Well, we can ask our listeners, you can start to give us a call if you like, what do you think about this, and what prices have you seen? Is there not something really nice, John, about a homely experience of sitting in your family home, the home you grew up in, maybe as a little boy or a little girl, and having Christmas dinner with your own children, with your own family? Is there something quite, is it nice to go out on Christmas Day, or is it quite cold compared to eating at home?
Well, Stephen, I mean, obviously, as a kid, I used to love the Christmas Day family dinner, but you know, my mum and dad, who are sadly no longer with us, they got old, and we decided whenever they were in their old age pensioners that we would take them out every Christmas as a family, and we'd take them to one of these hotels, book it early, and we actually enjoyed it.
Nice?
They enjoyed the fact that they weren't, you know, preparing stuff and cleaning up. So for one of those, for a reason like that, I actually enjoyed that as well.
I remember the time I took Big Audrey for Christmas Day to Portugal to a complete dump, which we were trapped in. The turkey was freezing. We were trapped. I booked it for something like a week and got out on Boxing Day. It was awful. Anyway, John, Merry Christmas. Can't believe I'm saying it. You looking forward to Christmas, Tommy? You looking forward to it, Tommy?
The busiest time of the year for us, so no, I'm very much looking forward to it. Also looking forward to the rest of getting Christmas Day off, Boxing Day, and let my heart down and let somebody else cook for a while.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, John.
Sure, it's Christmas once more.
Stephen Nolan Show! Morning, Norman.
Morning, Stephen.
Good
Stephen,
morning.
A Christmas dinner for the rich.
340 quid ahead.
That's over a week's, that's near 2 weeks' pension for me.
Well,
so it is. So how many pensioners could afford £340 for one dinner?
345 quid ahead at the merchant.
Aye. Uh-huh.
Well,
you couldn't do it.
It's a certain clientele,
Stephen,
isn't it?
I could probably go on a bus tour for a Christmas dinner on a day out for less than that.
Well, don't forget what you get for that 345 quid. Confit. I remember we used to put music behind this and read out the menu. We'll do it coming up to Christmas again. Confit, duck terrine, smoked duck breast, spiced fruit chutney, dressed white crab, Norman.
No, definitely not for my taste.
Brown crab mousse, twice baked souffle.
No, it doesn't appeal to me.
345 quid. That would be the starter. Traditional turkey glazed ham, chestnut stuffing.
No. Sage stuffing for me.
And the dessert is Valhorny chocolate yule. What's Valhorny?
Trifle.
Hold on a minute.
I've
mispronounced that. Valrhona, not Valhorny. Valrhona chocolate yule. Pear cremeau, pear sorbet.
I'm going out today with my friends for a dinner, and I can guarantee you I will get turkey and ham for less than £20 today. So why would I pay £340 for a turkey dinner when I could buy a turkey in Lidl's or Tesco's or wherever for £15 and me and my wife can have a turkey dinner at home?
Can I ask for your opinion and others listening to this programme this morning? Because myself and the Nolan team are on a little bit of a standoff at the moment, okay?
Right.
And it goes like this, Norman, that they're at the stage now where they're booking the Christmas dinner for for our Nolan Show outing,
and you're paying for
it. And they're booking places where there is, I don't know, like it's just so ridiculous. Pig's ear soup. Parsnip souffle soup, cabbage soup, and I'm saying,
cabbage soup would be all right now.
But I'm saying, hold on a minute, vegetable soup, turkey and ham, or I'm not going. And then they keep on coming up with it. We went somewhere last year where I swear to you, if I take my little finger and double it, that was the size of the turkey. It was this wee round circle of turkey with a wee kind of 2-inch bit of ham set on top of it. It was ridiculous.
Well, I got that one year when I went out for my dinner. That's all I say. It was like a postage stamp.
So what about the traditional Christmas dinner places where you get vegetable soup with crusty bread, you get a big slap of turkey with a big chunk of ham, mashed potato, plaster it with butter, and that's it. And this lot in here, they've got, they've got above their station now, Norman, where somehow those places are below them now. It's ridiculous.
If I go out with a church for a Christmas dinner, I can get a 3-course meal for £30.
Yes.
And coffee and tea after and biscuits.
Well, look, with these Christmas dinner prices, I'm actually thinking, should I open up Fantasy Island and stuff a few turkeys in the oven and...
Oh, if you invite me down.
Well, for 500 quid a head.
I'll give you £30.
You'll have to take your shoes off, though, because I've bought white carpet. That's another story.
I want you to spill your breakfast all over. So you will.
Do you think it would be nice going out for Christmas Day?
It is if the price is right, but for £345, no way. I would stay at home and cook my own dinner.
Well, now, to be fair to these places, the experience that they put on, they have to dress up the place, don't they?
No,
they have to pay
right.
the staff more money. Christmas Day is such a special day that to sacrifice that to provide a Christmas dinner for customers, what price do you put in that, you know?
Well, if our church can go for a Christmas dinner, a 3-course dinner for £30 a head, what's the difference?
Where's Birch Jazz Bar? I've never heard of it. Where's that?
Never heard of it.
Oh, that's part of the merchant.
Aye.
Well, you can get it a bit cheaper in Birch's.
So, Stephen, they talk about a cost of living.
240 quid per adult.
They talk about a cost of living crisis. I don't see it. So I don't. I don't see a cost of living crisis here at all. Because all the bus tours are packed. The airports are packed at Christmas, people flying away and flying in, people going and getting a big dinner for £340. Where's the cost of living crisis? Because I don't see it.
Thank you, Norman.
All right, Stephen, have a nice Christmas, you and your mum.
Morning to you. It's still only the 13th of November. Good morning. 030 30 80 55 55. Such an important interview on Good Morning Ulster this morning. If you didn't hear it, about the mother of an autistic son. 10 months he's in a mental health hospital, locked away, says his mother, robbed of a future. Southern Health Trust, their public statement, the Southern Health and Social Care Trust, that they don't comment on individual circumstances of any service user. Well, let's make sure that everybody else does. 030 30 80 55 55. Kerry Boyd of Autism NI, back with us this morning. Morning to you, Kerry.
Good morning.
I just couldn't believe it when I was driving in to work this morning. I could not believe it. So tell us about Sebastian and the wider picture. He's been assessed as being fit for discharge. What does that actually mean?
Well, according to his mother, Amanda, every specialist that Sebastian has met with and psychiatrist has said that he is basically fit for discharge. And he was fit for discharge after 2 weeks. But Sebastian, because there's no appropriate placement, has now been in a mental health hospital for 10 months.
And what's it like in a mental health hospital? Clearly, they're providing a service. We don't want to denigrate the staff in those hospitals or indeed the service that's provided. But no. What is it like being in there? The doors are locked and services are restricted or what?
Well, for an autistic person, it must be, ironically, as I said earlier on in Good Morning Ulster, it would be detrimental to their mental health because they don't have any mental health issues anymore, but they're in a mental health hospital with other patients. And for an autistic person, the sensory issues involved there too, you know, sounds, other patients there, lighting, all of that must be extremely overwhelming. And the point is, as you have said, he doesn't need to be there. He shouldn't be there. And we need to find appropriate placement for him. And I know the trusts do have this resettlement group that meet up, that join together, meet up to discuss appropriate placements, an oversight group basically. But at the minute, there doesn't seem to be appropriate placements for up to 25 adults who have complex needs and autism.
And for those people that live within the Southern Trust area, the Southern Trust are responsible for creating those places, are they?
Yes, and they are responsible for finding those places and ensuring that they are appropriate.
So, so whose job's on the line, or who's taking responsibility, or when they issue these statements that they won't talk about Sebastian, and then they say to this mother, and I wonder if the mother thinks this is some type of wind up. She's going public saying that they're locking my son away, and what's the Southern Trust do? First of all, they can't find anybody to actually come on the airwaves and speak about it. Secondly, here's what they publicly say. We're continuing to liaise directly with this family. Does the mum feel that's happening?
Well, I haven't spoken to the mum yet. I only found out about this yesterday. But I would say they probably are, you know, working with the mother. But it seems to be, as usual, down to a funding issue, probably, where there are no appropriate placements. And that is something that needs to be prioritised. It was prioritised whenever I'm sure everyone's seen the Spotlight programme, where the lack of respite care for autistic kids with complex needs. And the Minister for Health, Mike Nesbitt, was able to find $13 million for that. So, you know, again, this needs to be prioritised. We can't have people in mental health hospitals that shouldn't be there. It must be horrendous for that family.
Why though? Spell it out. Why? What's it like living in a mental health hospital?
Well, it's not a, they don't have the same training as they would have in a residential care for that autistic person. It's not going to be person centred, is it? It's not going to be the way it should be. You know, Sebastian probably has, he's non-verbal, but he probably has his own, special interests in certain things that could be surrounding him in a safe environment. And at the minute, he's just in with everybody else in a mental health hospital and with other patients too. I know of a case, I was explaining it earlier on the Radio Ulster show, of a adult in England who ended up in a mental health hospital for 30 years.
I heard you say this.
And he should have been discharged, obviously, years ago. He's now thriving in residential care, but he didn't have a family to fight his corner. And that was the bottom line. And it scares me that there will be people in the future, you know, whose parents have died or aren't about, that could end up in the same situation and never be able to get back out of it. So it's something that needs to be looked at, and I really encourage the Department of Health to oversee the whole lot of this in each health trust area.
Can lawyers not get involved here? Has Sebastian not got legal rights? Like, can the Southern Trust simply say, oh, well, they're liaising with the family and essentially they're not going to talk about Sebastian's case? Can his mother sue them? Has he got human rights to not be locked in a mental health hospital when the Southern Health Trust, it is their responsibility to create and find him a place?
Mm-hmm. It is, but as I said, it probably comes down to funding. And he is getting care within that placement. I'm 100% sure that within that mental health hospital, they are looking after him appropriately, but it's not what he needs as a human being. And as you say, human rights issue, he should be in an environment that is more suited to his needs at the minute. He doesn't have any more mental health issues, so he shouldn't be there. It's just like you or me. If we went in somewhere like that and after a couple of weeks we were seen to be fit to be let out, you should be let back out again. You shouldn't be kept there because there's nowhere else for you to go.
It was to be my next question. Mm-hmm. For everybody listening to this morning that does not have a disability or does not have autism or whatever other aspect that creates a difficulty in your life, imagine taking non-disabled people, locking them away and saying, sorry, we've no suitability for you to be in the community. Like, how is this any different? This is someone who should not be locked away, who is currently locked away for the guts of a year. Now, start thinking about that happening to non-disabled or people that don't have autism.
No, I totally agree. It's like a living nightmare, I would say, for the family. And it probably is quite stressful for those working within the mental health hospital too, because they know that Sebastian shouldn't be there. So it's a bigger issue. It's an issue of we need more residential care that can work with autistic people or those with complex needs or both within the community. And that's where he needs to be.
So whose responsibility? Look, the Southern Trust can't just click their fingers and, you know, these places appear. But this is for these suitable places in the community to appear. But this is about planning. So presumably there are people in each of these trusts that are responsible for these places being there for forward planning. The Department mm-hmm. of Health must have to play a role in this. Who ultimately is responsible for the places being available?
Well, there would be each health trust area. Obviously, we've got five health trusts, so each health trust area would be responsible for their own places, I presume. But they need to be, as you say, forward planning. They need to be asking that funding. I can't answer that, but I hope they are. I do feel like over the past number of years working in the role that I work in, it has been very frustrating that Stormont has been up and down so many times as well. So we haven't had, you know, a Minister for Health in position, you know, to make, you know, oversee these decisions as well. So I think all of that has affected waiting lists in general. But in this particular case, it does need to be prioritised. And as I said before, with the respite care for autistic kids, the minister was able to find 13 million for that. And surely now with, you know, it shouldn't have to come to a BBC radio programme for it to be highlighted. This should be, you know, be done innately where they're thinking forward planning and, you know, they're caring about where these people are. As I said, he's lucky enough to have a parent who has highlighted this. What about the ones that don't have any living parents or any family that's fighting their case? What's happening to them?
And Sebastian, who the Southern Trust, I again will repeat, and isn't it convenient, they won't talk about him. Isn't that convenient that they won't talk about Sebastian as an individual? But Sebastian was born with autism. Mm-hmm. He first started respite care when he was four. Mm-hmm. His mum needed help because she felt his behaviour was no longer manageable at home. Mm-hmm. He went to live in a home for children that catered for his needs. So there he was, as a child, and he's being helped and he's being catered for and he's developing and all of that. But he turns 18. So he can't live in that home for children. Now, again, his age when he turns 18. It's not a miracle. Who was planning for what happened to him after 18? Who was thinking about it? So he has a meltdown in January. He's detained in a mental health hospital. The people around him work with him. And within a couple of weeks, he's ready to get out again. And he is locked away. Northern Ireland, the Department of Health, the Southern Trust, whoever else is responsible, this person cannot speak for himself. And this guy is locked away, locked in a building when he should be free with help and services around him. Like, are we in the 18th century here where we put disabled people in dungeons or something?
I know. And it sounds horrendous because, as you said, he was in residential care before that with children, and he was thriving. And only because he had one mental health incident did he end up in this hospital. And now he can't get back out again because there's no appropriate placement. So it is up to the health trust, and this group that seems to meet regularly, this oversight group for placement, needs to be asking the Department of Health for more funding for appropriate placements.
Now, the trust in their statement to the BBC, to Good Morning Ulster, and our colleagues in BBC News, they say, we provide a patient-centred and holistic approach to the care of our patients and service users. As part of that care, all our inpatients have access to green spaces alongside opportunities to participate in purposeful and meaningful daily activities. Patient-centred and holistic approach.
Mm-hmm.
Are the doors locked? Can
I
get
know.
Out?
For certain cases, that may not be appropriate or not appropriate. They may not be able to do that. I'm not sure with Sebastian if he's allowed out or not. As I said, I only heard about this case yesterday. But I would like to think that that was happening. But, you know, it may not be happening, but it doesn't really matter. He shouldn't be there in the first place. And if you look at the cost as well of this, you want to look at it from a cost benefit analysis, so to speak, which you shouldn't be. But if you want to look at it like that, I would, from my knowledge, that's far more expensive to keep him in there than to find residential care for him.
And look, my brain is doubling back here in that I'm thinking to myself, am I being unfair talking about, you know, people with a disability, you know, liking it to being in a dungeon, because this is a regulated mental health hospital who will be doing their best. But you look at what Mum is saying. My son is living in hospital because he has autism, plain and simple. He's autistic. I feel like nobody could be bothered with him anymore. My child does not belong in a building like that. Every specialist that he's come across and even the psychiatrists have said he does not belong there. So look, I probably have gone too far asking, you know, using the term dungeon. But what does it feel like to his mother and him?
I would say it'd be very frightening for him. He's obviously came from a place where he was very used to that environment. And as his mother said, he enjoyed it. He thrived in that environment, to a mental health hospital, which was there to specifically help him with his mental health needs. That was sorted within 2 weeks. He should have been then let back out and back into appropriate care where they can, you know, individualise his support. And at the minute, that's not happening.
And let's be fair to the staff also in the mental health hospital.
No, because they're there to do a job, but the job is not to look after autistic people.
And Mum has said,
because of their autism.
And Mum has said the staff dealing with her son were very
good. Yes.
Very good. So there's no question on the staff here. But she says, look, a more experienced team is needed to manage his behavioural issues. So actually, look, I'm doing this live programme. I apologise for saying dungeon. Nobody's asked me to apologise. I'm just thinking for this myself. But here's what she says. She says, to see his giant teddy bear sitting on the bed beside him, he's stressed, he cries a lot, he's limited access to the outside world, he has no life. This is what we're doing to Sebastian. This is what we're doing to this individual and others. This is the point. And others.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's such an important story. I'm sure our colleagues in BBC News will be following this up, as will we. And if you've got a story I see other people or someone else, myself, my wife, my daughter in the same case. If you want to pick up the phone to us, 030 30 80 55 55. Next, private members bill, which would allow assisted dying for the terminally ill in England and Wales, has been published in Westminster. Gavin Walker is a campaigner for voluntary assisted dying legislation in Northern Ireland. Morning, Gavin.
Stephen, how are you?
Good morning, the former Health Minister, DUP MLA, Jim Wells. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. I know this would need to be discussed here at Stormont, but MPs will be given a chance to vote on plans for England and Wales. It's a live discussion, Gavin. Tell us what your thoughts are.
My thoughts are very succinctly, Stephen, are that this is something we need to talk about over here, as you said. No matter what happens in Westminster, this will not apply to Northern Ireland. So it's really, I think it should be looked at as a possible blueprint for a conversation for us to have here. Because right now, the people in Northern Ireland are the only ones across these islands who are not involved in a conversation about assisted dying. Everywhere else, it's in the political arena, and here we haven't even started the conversation. So I think we need to look at our MLAs and say, why are you not starting this conversation from this point? Take this as your starting point and go from there, and allow us to have an opportunity to express how we feel about this issue. And in the poll we had in August by Lucid Talk, we can tell you that there are 67% of people in Northern Ireland want to have assisted dying legislation introduced here.
Jim?
Well, I think it's inevitable that there will be a debate and vote in Northern Ireland in the Assembly on the subject. The Irish Republic, the Isle of Man, Scotland, England and Wales are all having that, and I think history has shown us it's coming our way. All I can say is I think that when people have a long and intelligent debate about this subject, they'll be like Westreating the Health Minister, they will change their minds. So I welcome this debate because I think that the statistics and the information from other countries are so overwhelming, and that the people will have pulled back from going down this very difficult route.
That's entirely incorrect, Jim. I'm sorry. There are people where the assisted dying is in place are very supportive of the laws that they have. In Oregon, they've actually voted in twice. In Australia, they're about to have a review of it and do it again. And even in Canada, the bogeyman that everybody brings up, 80% of the people living there agree that with the assisted dying laws that they have. So it's incorrect to say the people who have this in place do not like how it works out. It is a way of showing compassion as a society to those who find themselves at the end of their life and who need to have some choice in how they bring their life to a conclusion.
Well, I think there's a different moral compass from Northern Ireland to Canada, and I think when people see what's happening in Canada and the huge numbers involved,
I'm sorry for interrupting. The issue here is that the law that Kim Leadbetter has brought forward in Westminster is based on the Oregon experience. So let's look at the Oregon experience. 0.25% of the people who have terminal illness choose to have an assisted death. That number hasn't changed. The laws in Oregon haven't changed over 25 years. There is no reason to start to say that things will become thousands of people lining up to have an assisted death. That just doesn't happen. So let's look at the Oregon experience and see how we could maybe transfer that to the Northern Ireland experience. But more particularly, have a conversation here where we have an opportunity to look at that and say, well, we like this part and this part, but don't like that part. We would do that differently. We need to have a conversation here that creates the law that is right for us as a community.
Well, I welcome this debate, and I think there's strong arguments. I'll be honest, there's strong arguments on both sides. But I think when we look even a bit further into the Oregon experience and listen to those who are at the front line, the palliative care nurses, the consultants, and listen to them, I think Northern Ireland will step back from this.
Well, look, let's see. Obviously, we're out of time this morning, but we will take your calls tomorrow and the next day and throughout the weeks on this. It's such an important story, isn't it? We're just running out of time today. But Jim and Gavin, thank you very much indeed. In the meantime, thank you for listening this morning as well. Nolan@bbc.co.uk is the email address. If you want to continue talking to us about all the different issues we've been discussing this morning, at Stephen Nolan on Twitter. We'll see you back here. It'll be Thursday morning tomorrow for more Nolan at 9. Have a good day, everyone, and thanks for listening.
biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.